You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll take a look at OPEC's decision to lower oil production and what it means for prices around the world. First, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes sailed through the Democratic primary in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race, thanks in part to his progressive record and prominent liberal endorsements. But the very things that made him a favorite among the Democratic base have been attacked as liabilities in his campaign against Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Rich Kramer reports.
On a rural St. Croix County farm in mid-September, a small crowd of Democrats have come to rally behind Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Minnesota U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar is the featured speaker. She praises Barnes and says he would compliment Wisconsin's other senator, Democrat Tammy Baldwin.
And in my mind, you shouldn't have one incredible, awesome, respected U.S. senator out of the state of Wisconsin. You should have two!
Barnes won the Democratic primary for Senate with endorsements from progressive icons like U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Klobuchar is a different kind of Democrat. She's run as a moderate, and at this rally, she's appealing to a different kind of voter.
And you tell your friends, whether they are independents, moderate Republicans in this district, a district that has supported Democrats in the past, you tell them our very democracy is on the line.
But in a hyper-competitive state like Wisconsin, that's easier said than done. Since the primary, Barnes has been hit with a wave of Republican attack ads describing him as a radical liberal. And they appear to have made a mark.
The Republicans are putting on a clinic right now.
That's UW La Crosse political science professor Anthony Chergosky.
They are putting on a case study in how to run an effective negative campaign against an opponent.
The main attacks against Barnes have portrayed him as soft on crime.
Do you feel safe? Mandela Barnes would eliminate cash bail.
Some show video of him suggesting funding from law enforcement can be shifted to pay for social services. Others highlight his calls 4 years ago to cut the prison population in half. Republicans have amplified their message with money. An analysis by the watchdog group Open Secrets shows that between the candidates and outside groups, Republicans have outspent Democrats by roughly $20 million. Democratic strategist Joe Zepecki says despite that, it's still a close race between Johnson and Barnes. He says Democrats at the national level should take notice.
In the 11 elections statewide since Donald Trump won in 2016, the Democratic candidate or the Democratic-backed candidate has won 10 of them. 10 of 11. We know how to win here, but we need the resources to do it.
This month, the Barnes campaign is trying to shift voters' focus back to Ron Johnson. They've run ads highlighting Johnson's long anti-abortion record.
But it's Johnson's views that are alarming. Johnson supported a ban on abortions.
And Barnes has taken that message on the road. During a stop last week at an Eau Claire cafe, Barnes met with a group of women to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that struck down Roe v. Wade. He says Johnson's past votes for a national abortion ban are too extreme for Wisconsin.
The reality is Ron Johnson is just not there for us, and he is not the person to be trusted when it comes to women's health.
The UW La Crosse's Chergosky says the counterattack could mean the race hinges on a sliver of independent voters. He says they'll have to decide whether they see Barnes as a candidate who has said things about public safety that make them uncomfortable, or whether they see Johnson as a candidate out of step with the public on abortion. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR's profile of U.S. Senator Ron Johnson aired yesterday. You can find both those stories at WPR.org. Now, the Saudi Arabian-led OPEC, Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, cut oil production by up to 2 million barrels a day in association with a wider group called OPEC Plus. That came after months of declining gas prices in the U.S. from a peak in the summer. It's raising concerns about higher fuel costs around the world. Some members of Congress are responding by pushing for a bill called NOPEC that would alter antitrust laws so the Justice Department could sue nations involved in setting prices for oil, petroleum, and natural gas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the Biden administration should react to OPEC cutting oil production? Are you worried about the rising cost of gas? What questions do you have about the world market in oil and what it means for the prices we pay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Jim Crane is a Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute, specializing in energy geopolitics with a focus on oil exporting countries. His books include Energy Kingdoms and City of Gold, Dubai, and the Dream of Capitalism. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
I want to set the stage here a little bit. I've been looking at charts. So the U.S. is the top oil-producing country in the world. Number two and three, you got Russia and Saudi Arabia. And you've been following this. Those two countries have been cooperating some since the U.S. Emerged as the top oil production country again. What's going on?
Yeah, well, it's sort of one of these backstories that you don't hear about that much. One of the downsides of the U.S. shale boom is that, OPEC countries could no longer, influence the market as much as they used to by cutting production. Because every time they would cut, U.S. shale producers would kind of swoop in behind and increase their market share. So the Saudis and the Russians started to cooperate. They were kind of pushed together by the market. And this, kicked off in a small way in 2016, and it's been getting stronger ever since.
How harmonious is this relationship between, I guess, the Saudi-led OPEC and the Russian-led part of what they're calling OPEC Plus?
Well, it's I'm not sure I'd call it harmonious, but they seem to be acting they're cooperating really closely. I guess there's only been one, and it's been a pretty major exception, one time when it hasn't worked out, and that was right when the COVID pandemic was hitting, and the Saudis wanted a big cut in oil production, and Russians declined to go along with that. So Saudi, whipped into price war mode and cranked up production. So it's basically the only way that the Saudis can punish, quota cheaters or, enforce discipline is to really crank up their production, push down the oil price. It hurts everybody. But that's what they did. And that was under President Trump. President Trump made a bunch of phone calls, kind of got things, got the other, the Saudis and the Russians back on the same page. And after a month, that price war was called off. But other than that, the Saudi-Russian relationship has been surprisingly strong. Those of us watching it have been surprised. It's been, the Russians and Saudis have kind of made common cause even after, Russia invaded Ukraine and, after these, attacks on civilians and, et cetera. It's been pretty interesting that, the time at, given very various opportunities, the Saudis continue to back Russia, at least in through OPEC with their oil policy. So interesting new development.
All right, now that takes us to the new development over the last week, this announcement that OPEC and OPEC Plus, Saudi Arabia and Russia mainly, we're going to cut oil production 2 million barrels a day. Sounds like a lot. Media reports are treating it like a lot. I'm looking at the chart of oil costs today. It doesn't look like it's going through the roof. How big a deal is this?
Politically, it's a huge deal. It's being treated an extraordinary breach in U.S.-Saudi relations that date back to the 40s. The Saudis have been basically in the U.S. camp as a pretty reliable ally, going all the way back to, the end of World War II. So it's a new and unfamiliar, experience for us. In terms of oil prices, it's less of a big deal. A lot of the OPEC and OPEC plus countries weren't able to raise production as much as they were allowed under the OPEC quota system. So they were already underproducing. But this cut still reduces, the global oil supply, by about 1%, by about a million barrels a day. So, it's still it's a big cut, right? And it's taken place, when oil inventories are still pretty tight. It's a really unfamiliar OPEC action. We're used to them kind of acting to stabilize markets, especially at a time when inflation is running rampant. You've got central banks all over the world trying to cope with high inflation. And when oil inventories around the world are low, this was, really unexpected.
So one response could be, okay, we've got all these American oil producers. Can we, in the United States, up production to match the cut in production over there?
We can. It's possible. But, oil producers in the U.S., there's multiple thousands of them. They are private companies. They're not state-owned companies. They don't take orders from the federal government or from state governments, really, or anybody but the market and their investors, right? So, you know, private equity firms and banks, et cetera, those that, you know, and their shareholders. And right now, you know, for the past, gosh, 2 years and change, you know, those investors have been cautioning U.S. oil producers that they don't want to see over-exuberant production. They want capital discipline is the new mantra in the oil patch here in the U.S. So they want profits, not production growth. And, you know, unfortunately for the Biden administration and for U.S. motorists, you know, that's who, you know, oil producers listen to. They listen to the market and their investors. They don't really take orders from the president. I mean, you know, Jennifer Granholm, all the way back in, what was it, March, she was here in Houston. You know, we have a big, you know, oil themed conference here called CERAWeek. And she was pleading with all the oil producers gathered in the room, hundreds and hundreds of them, to start raising production and to get on a war footing. But we really haven't seen that.
We're talking to Jim Crane from Rice University's Baker Institute, specializing in energy geopolitics, looking at OPEC's decision to cut oil production, what it means for international politics and for gas prices. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see Congress or the White House do in response to this cut in oil production from Saudi Arabia and Russia and their partners? Do you want to see more production here in the United States? What questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jim Crane from Rice University. With us today to talk about OPEC and OPEC Plus, a wider group of oil producers, cutting oil production by up to 2 million barrels a day. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about the oil market around the world, how it works, and how it translates into gas prices. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Michael is with us in Mequon. Michael, hi.
Hi, and thanks for letting me make some comments. I'd like to see a windfall profits tax on the oil companies with the caveat that if they increase production, those increases decrease. So they have an incentive to increase oil production. I'd also like to see some tax policies that make it more appealing to invest in refineries. We've lost about a dozen refineries over the last 3 years. And some incentives for the oil companies to, or other producers to expand their capabilities.
Michael, thanks for that call. Jim, first of all, that idea of a tax incentive saying if prices go up, basically, and you don't increase production, you're going to get hit with taxes, oil producers. What do you think of that notion?
I haven't heard that one yet. You know, I mean, probably be tricky to apply, but... I don't know. Who knows? I mean, I generally like a little less intervention than more, but who knows? It might work.
And our caller raises concerns also about refineries. There's not a straight line between oil prices and gasoline prices. Can you talk about the refinery? Keep wanting to say distillery. Refinery part of the picture.
Right. Yeah, it's true that refining capacity is in short supply globally right now and in the U.S. I mean, you know, actually one of our refineries here in Houston closed down during the pandemic. So and then, you know, demand bounced back a lot faster than lots of folks thought it would. So yes, I mean, there is some truth to that. We do need some more refining capacity. They're running at full tilt right now. You got to remember that a lot of the, you know, a lot of that's for export. So a lot of what our refineries process goes for exports. We export a lot of refined products, so it's not just for the U.S. market.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to get to this idea. It's bounced around Congress before, getting more talk now, the so-called NOPEC bill, allowing, in effect, the Justice Department to file antitrust suits, I guess, against countries who collude to keep oil prices high. Can you talk a little more about that, what it might do, and whether you think it might be effective?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's basically lift sovereign immunity on national oil companies that are owned by the state, and you could sue them in U.S. courts essentially for price fixing. This bill, I've always been against it, but potentially with a small caveat, because things are a little different now with Russia and an effective member of OPEC. But this thing has been introduced something like 16 times in the past 22 years, and it's never been passed. It's interesting because it's popular with both parties. And I've always argued that it's a bad idea. Basically, it punishes sovereign countries for activities that occur outside U.S. borders, right? So it's going to push them to avoid the dollar. We might see, oil is priced in dollars worldwide. We might see, an increase in oil being priced in other currencies, the Chinese yuan, the euro or the yen, et cetera. But it would also push companies that have assets in the U.S. to sell them, right? So, like Saudi Aramco has a huge amount of assets, including the biggest refinery in the United States here in the U.S., a wholly owned refinery here in Texas. And it would also, OPEC essentially helps U.S. producers. I mean, we're the biggest beneficiary of OPEC's cuts. U.S. oil producers are. We've been the largest oil producer since 2018. And, U.S. oil producers don't participate in those cuts. I mean, we don't have a national oil company. So, we kind of get to free ride on the cuts and benefit from them. So it's it's the best of both worlds for U.S. producers. Now, Russia's now in OPEC, functionally, one of the two leaders of OPEC. OPEC is acting differently than it used to. I mean, it used to be all about stabilizing the market, and they now, seem to be putting political and economic self-interests ahead of market stability. So there's more of an adversarial bent that we're seeing in OPEC. I guess I have questions about it now. I'm not sure NOPEC is the best way to address those, but it's something that should certainly be discussed in Congress.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Spooner. Paul, hello.
I thank you for everything you're handling today, and I think I just heard it. What we really need here is a national oil company, and that's what Joe Biden should do. I mean, we have OPEC that has given, and we have our own government that's given drilling rights to our own federal land, and today is what it was meant for, is to control the price so that we have our own identity. Why don't we just start drilling oil, build a refinery? Every time prices get high, we're going to dump it out on the market, and we're going to control the oil prices for our people, our own oil for our own people.
Paul, thanks for the call. So a couple of things there. First of all, he's suggesting, in effect, nationalizing part of the oil industry, I think. I don't know that that's been on the table much, Jim.
No, not really, but there is something in that, right? So, the releases that the Biden administration's been allowing from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is almost like, having it's almost like a nationalization. It's a supply of crude oil that the federal government has control over. It's one of the few things that the federal government can do. It's being used in a kind of a novel way right now. Normally we rely on the Saudis to bring their spare production capacity online. And that's kind of the U.S. president and the federal government's best tool to combat high gasoline prices is to get the Saudis to help us out. Well, that didn't work this time around, and it's not been working for Biden at all. And so he's got this, the SPR release. There's some folks that think this could be institutionalized. Actually, we don't need to just leave that oil in the ground, except for emergencies. There's a lot of oil there, and that we could use it to influence prices domestically, kind of institutionalize that. But I think it's something we should discuss publicly, through Congress, rather than by presidential fiat.
Big picture, Jim, what does all of this kind of turmoil in the oil industry mean for renewable energy, efforts to wean ourselves off of reliance on oil and its various fuel-related derivatives?
Well, it's great for that. I mean, so, you know, oil has got a monopoly on transportation. It's really the only transportation fuel we have. Something, you know, 90-some percent of transportation is powered by oil. So, you know, I think this is telling us, well, you know, that's not good for us, that we need substitutes for oil. We need alternate technologies and that, you know, we're going to be a lot less exposed to these kind of geopolitics, you know, happening around different places around the world. If we've got viable substitutes and alternatives for oil. So I think it's going to push things in a good direction ultimately, and also make us, you know, more efficient. I mean, the, you know, motorists in America, we're famous for driving, you know, the most inefficient vehicles in the world, big and, you know, high energy consumption vehicles. So, you know, it doesn't need to be that way.
That's maybe in the longer term. What are you watching for in the next couple few weeks, just in our last half a minute, when it comes to oil and gas prices?
What I'm looking for is to see if there's some, if there's a little bit of regret and maybe a small, you know, policy concession on behalf of the Saudis. I mean, I think they're under a lot of pressure right now, potential for their relationship to really be damaged with the U.S. since we're their main provider of hard security. That's not a good thing for them either. So hopefully we'll see them come around.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Jim Crane, a Wallace S. Wilson Fellow for Energy Studies at Rice University's Baker Institute, specializing in energy geopolitics. He joins us to talk about this cut in oil production by OPEC and the wider group OPEC Plus, which includes Russia. So you've got the second and third leading oil producers in the world, Russia and Saudi Arabia, getting together on that. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, meet the creators of the WPR podcast Uprooted, looking at the lives of Cuban refugees here in Wisconsin. You can check out the podcast at WPR.org. Find out more tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. It's not the great pumpkin, but it's a great pumpkin. We have a winner in the Safeway World Championship Pumpkin Weigh-Off. As reported by NPR, the winner came from next door in Minnesota with a weigh-in of 2,560 pounds. That's a lot. That's a ton of pumpkin, and then some. It's not a world record pumpkin, though. The largest recorded pumpkin weighed in at more than 2,700 pounds. That was last year in Italy. So what do you do with a 2,500-pound pumpkin after you win the big contest? The owner plans now to break his record for the heaviest ever jack-o'-lantern, hopefully in time for Halloween, and sell the seeds. I guess there's good money in giant pumpkin seeds. More pumpkin news coming up tomorrow. Jonathan Van Ness from Queer Eye joins the show with a surprising amount of pumpkin-related content. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, do you know your life expectancy? What's the number that pops into your head? We know the average life expectancy has been going up for the most part for decades. It's already much higher probably than whenever you were born. And our next guest says thanks to cutting-edge medical and technological advances, it's likely we're all going to live a lot longer in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about some of the latest research in longevity, living longer and living healthier along the way, our guest says? Is there a medical development that you look back on and say, yeah, that's helped me live a lot longer, or someone in my family? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you want to live to 150? Does that sound like a good idea? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dr. Michael Roizen is Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic and a professor at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. His books include What to Eat When and Age Proof. He's co-author of the new book, The Great age reboot, cracking the longevity code for a younger tomorrow. Dr. Roizen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's a privilege to join you. Thank you very much.
Before we dig into some of the specific developments, you and your co-authors are saying we're really on the verge of something big when it comes to longevity. How much could things change in the next 50 years or so?
Well, in the next 10 years, we expect that life expectancy will increase by about 30 years with an 80% probability. Let me go back a little bit. We've increased life expectancy, that is sanitation, public health, and the medical community, medical science community, has gone from about 42 or 43 in 1890 to about 78 now. And we expect with at least an 80% probability, because there are what we call 14 shots on goal, 14 hot areas of exponentially increasing research into the basic mechanism of aging that have been going on and that have transformed, each has transformed at least two animal species. We expect that a 30-year increase in life expectancy will be probable. In 1998, when Real Age came out, when we published Real Age, we said that 60 was likely to be the new 40. It has happened. We're now saying that 90 is likely to be the new 40. That is, you won't just be living longer, you'll be living younger.
One thing I want to get into at the outset here is people might hear the technologies you're talking about and think, great, I don't need to take care of myself. Medical science is going to fix whatever goes wrong with me, you know, in the next 20 or 30 years or whatever. That is exactly the opposite of what you're encouraging people to think. Can you tell us how you're hoping this influences our behavior today?
That's exactly right, because although sometime in the future, maybe by 2050, you'll go in a car wash as a 90-year-old at one end and come out a 40-year-old at the other end. But for the foreseeable future, it's organ system by organ system, which means that in order to enjoy this longevity, the changes that are happening, that we've got to keep ourselves as young as possible so that the organs don't get what you would call structural change that's irreparable before the change happens that's allowing us to reboot them to a younger organ. And so the point is we've got to do everything we can. In fact, it's kind of our responsibility to society to do everything we can, as well as to ourselves, to keep everything as young as possible, especially your brain and nervous system, because that's the one we expect to be the hardest to reboot.
Talking to Dr. Michael Roizen about his new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. You can join in with your thoughts, your reactions to what you're hearing, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Dr. Roizen, let's look at what might be in the works today. Let's start off with the idea of, you know, a 3D printer. We've seen those, but maybe 3D printers that can give us replacement organs?
Yeah, in fact, one of the joys of this, of being in the field that I'm in, that is getting to follow longevity, is they had a contest last year. It was an open contest for the last 5 years. Who would be the first to be able to print a viable, functioning in all three areas, liver? And Team Winston at Winston-Salem University, at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, won that last year. The liver is a complex organ. It both produces proteins, it excretes compounds, including drugs. It has bile ducts as well as arteries and veins. And it's incredibly important in synthesis, in excretion, and in metabolism. And they, working with human stem cells, working with living stem cells from people's bone marrow, were able to reproduce a human liver. Now, we already know we can produce bones, we can produce jaws, we can even produce tracheas, but this was a breakthrough in producing a liver, which is a very, it's maybe the third or fourth most complex organ in the human body.
How far are we from, you know, that proof of concept, I guess, to, yeah, we need a transplant of a complex organ like a liver, and we don't need a donor. We can grow one, maybe using some of our own biology.
So whether we get the breakthrough in this area or in one of the others, we expect that every one of these 14 areas has done this in at least two animal species. So they've done the liver transplant in pigs and in mice. Now it is, so you're saying, how long before we, well, it's ongoing. It'll be ongoing in humans experimentally. And we expect within 10 years, each of these areas will have a breakthrough into humans, that at least one of them will succeed. So my favorite, of course, is, and my co-author Albert Ratner's favorite, is the regressing of white fat to what we call mother fat, pluripotent fat, and then its transformation into brown fat and eliminating obesity and all the diseases such as arthritis and type 2 diabetes and the other diseases that go along with it. What do we mean? So when you're young, when you're a newborn, you have brown fat. It surrounds your key organs and keeps them warm when your mom can't swaddle you or doesn't have the time to swaddle you at all times to keep you warm. But it comes from what we call mother fat or pluripotent fat. In three species, and I'll tell you the largest one was sheep, and we'll tell you why in a second, they regressed the white fat that we have around our intestines and that hangs off our belly and that causes inflammation in us to mother fat, and then turned it into brown fat and eliminated obesity. The largest animal was sheep. Why did they do it in sheep at Clemson? Well, they did it there because it turns out sheep can't stop eating either, and they develop non-alcoholic fatty liver disease just like humans, and die and stop being able to produce wool, so that the sheep farmers wanted that to see if they could do that. And so that's been done in at least sheep experimentally. So these are some of the changes. Now you'd say, are there inexpensive ones? And yes, as well as some of those that are more designed, such as gene therapy, and more specific and expensive. We just had an approval of gene therapy for beta thalassemia and sickle cell disease in the United States, a expensive therapy. It uses relatively inexpensive parts, if you will, drugs, but the drug company charges a lot because of the regulatory approval process and because of their profit motive. But in fact, some of these are already approved drugs that are very inexpensive.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm all for having people be healthy, but I really don't understand the increased longevity piece, because we already have a lack of medical health workers, the lack of CNAs and other people in nursing homes and in the medical field. We have older people who are lonely, and I'm just not understanding increasing, you know, till age 90 or beyond, when there's already not enough help for people.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Great questions. And Dr. Royzen, you and your co-authors talk about some of the social and economic adaptations this increase in longevity would require.
Right. I think her name was Elizabeth, the caller, and I apologize
Elizabeth,
if I missed
yep.
the name. But Elizabeth, so take a 90-year-old of now isn't going to be the 90-year-old of 10 years from now. That's why longevity will be a huge disruptor. And that's really why we wrote the book, so that people can plan for it. Because a 90-year-old will function like the 40-year-old of today. That's with at least an 80% probability. And what do we mean by that? Well, instead of work life being from 20 or 25 to 65, if you retire at 65 and live to 115, you're not going to want to do that because you're going to do nothing for 50 years. So you're going to expand work life from 25 to 65 to from 25 to maybe 90 or 95. And that's going to be productive work life. Think of the 95-year-old as a 55-year-old or a 60-year-old today. That's what it's going to be like. And yes, you're absolutely right. We don't have enough healthcare workers and care accessibility for the elderly now. But this change, just like we've jumped over, I mean, the chip was the last disruptor about 60 years ago, and it's improved our lives in substantial ways. We now have more power on in our phones than we did for all of IBM 360 computers that took rooms of chips, if you will, in the past. Well, that same power is going to occur in medicine, we believe, and longevity will be the next disruptor, and it will make, if we plan for it right, and I can tell you already, Australia, Singapore, and Denmark are planning for it fiscally correctly. If we do that, as well as they do it, and that's really why we wrote the book, to get that discussion going. If we plan for it as well as they did it, it will cause an enormous thriving in, if you will, Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, because we'll be able to have much better access because we won't be dealing with many of the chronic diseases at any place near as early as we have to deal with them now. Just imagine eliminating obesity and the consequences. Most arthritis is due to obesity, and it's in and the inflammation causes. Most type 2 diabetes is due to that. A lot of cardiovascular disease and cancer and dementia are due to that. Well, imagine eliminating that, Elizabeth, and that's what you've got. And that's why it really does take a mind shift and an emotional change to understand how big this disruptor is likely to be.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Michael Royzen, Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic. His new book is The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts, your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Dr. Michael Royzen, Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic, looking at his new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Jeanette is with us in Sparta. Jeanette, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I was just listening to it and kind of thinking about kind of how our country operates in terms of, you know, public institutions like universities coming up with these really great technologies, and then once they get passed off to the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry, they end up, you know, prices skyrocket, and the average person can't afford them. So I'm wondering what your guest
interesting
feels about that.
Jeanette, thanks for the call. Dr. Royzen, today's economic disparities when it comes to health, will they just be replicated with these new longevity technologies?
You know, the hope is not, but the fear is yes. And that's why, again, why we wrote the book, to talk about the policies. And so the first third of the book is on these 14 areas of research. The next third is on the policies and economics of it. And the last third is what you can do to prepare for it, both financially and physically, that is, in your medical care. But some of these are very cheap. Let me give you two examples. At the Gladstone, I'll give you three examples because I can't resist. At the Gladstone in San Francisco, they looked at every drug already approved by the FDA and looked at their ability to block the functioning of the APOE4 gene, which is known to increase dementia by about threefold. They found that Bumetamide, which is a $4 a month water pill, already approved now, $4 a month, it's generic, won't go back, won't become non-generic. So $4 a month, and it reversed 70% of the functioning of that gene, so that in fact, when they looked at people taking that water pill in a 12 million person database compared to people taking other water pills, butimetadine or butimetamide, Bumex, decreased the incidence of dementia 70%. That now is undergoing, under NIH's auspices, a very, if you will, not a private drug company, a randomized controlled trial to look, does it do it in a prospective group? At the Cleveland Clinic, they did the same, but looked at the difference in protein attachment of tau and amyloid with every approved drug. Again, they looked at 1,563 drugs and found that Viagra, women use Viagra for pulmonary hypertension, men for erectile dysfunction. They found that Viagra decreased the attachment and decreased in a 15 million person database. 69% it decreased dementia rates. That's now undergoing, again, a randomized controlled trial under NIH auspices. And the two together, bumetamide and Viagra, are undergoing it together. Those are both generic drugs, so they should be very inexpensive in the future. Now, let me give you one more, and my favorite example of all. I told you, my co-author, Mr. Ratner, Albert Ratner's favorite, which was, of course, the transformation of white fat to brown fat. But my favorite is actually in the AMBAR studies, AMBAR, which was a plasma exchange. Now, we do plasma exchange donation of plasma, and we pay college students and graduate students, et cetera, to do it. So it's not very expensive. You take away the plasma, you wash the red cells, give those back, and you replace the plasma with salt water, saline. Doing that in patients with early Alzheimer's disease reversed this in a randomized controlled trial of around 300 people, what we call phase 2B3A study, sponsored by a foundation. Now, the technology to do this is not solely owned by any one company, and they're now, but that foundation is now sponsoring a 3,000, and by the way, it was done at six places worldwide, two in Spain, two in Chile, and the University of Pittsburgh and Cleveland Clinic in the United States. It's now being done in 100 different sites for 3,000 patients, and within 2 or 3 years, we'll know if this is a viable technique for preventing dementia. And by the way, when it was used in animal models, it also prevented skin aging. It reversed the aging of muscle and pancreas, and even, if you will, other cardiovascular system organs. And this stemmed from the young blood to old animals made the old animal young. Well, it wasn't that it was the young blood to the old animal. It was the old animal getting rid of its old proteins. And this is thought that it relates to protein misformation or malformation in that is still lingering in plasma and us not having young proteins or normal signaling proteins in our blood. So we'll know within 3 years whether that, and that's really cheap. And the good news is they're competitors in the field. And so it shouldn't be very expensive at all for those. And there, if you look at the 14 areas, at least 7 of them are very inexpensive and should be able to be, have competitors enough that they will be and stay inexpensive.
And Dr. Roizen, just in our last half a minute or so, leave us with one piece of health advice to protect ourselves until these things come online.
You're a genetic engineer. So when you exercise and stress a muscle, it turns on a gene that produces a risin that goes to the blood-brain barrier and increases the size of your hippocampus, your memory center in your brain. So by you speed of processing games, are the one game, crossword puzzles a little bit, executive a little bit, but speed of processing games and speed of exercise, stressing muscles, are two very important things for your brain.
Dr. Roizen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank the
questioners.
That's Dr. Michael Roizen, Emeritus Chief Wellness Officer at the Cleveland Clinic, professor at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. We've been talking about his new book, The Great Age Reboot, Cracking the Longevity Code for a Younger Tomorrow.